This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Unemployment has been a hot topic throughout the pandemic, and we're going to take a look at what's going on right now with some updates. We have Justin Hicks, workforce development reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Thanks for joining us, Justin.
Yeah, of course. Hey, Miriam.
Well, what's the latest news around unemployment in Indiana that you've been covering?
Well, the latest news is that we are sort of hovering at around 4% unemployment. I think it's 4.1% actually, seasonally adjusted right now. So I guess the latest news is that there's not a ton of news. You know, no news is news as well. And what that really means is, you know, as things have sort of normalized a little bit, people are getting sort of used to the new normal, businesses and workers alike getting used to that. You know, things in the workforce have just kind of stayed in kind of a stasis. The big question, of course, will be as Delta variant has really increased. I mean, and we're seeing those alarming numbers in virus infection rates. The question will be actually the next couple months, since all the data is kind of late. It's probably about 2 months late. The question is really going to be more about in the future, when we finally get that data, what will the effects of the Delta variant be to the workforce?
Well, speaking of the future, is it too early to be hopeful about the future of employment here in Indiana with these sort of static numbers you mentioned?
Yeah, I don't think it's too early to be hopeful. I think a lot of economists that I've talked to still feel like things are pretty stable. Because again, I mean, back in March of 2020, you know, that's when you saw March and April. That's when you really start to see the unemployment rate just take a crazy turn. I mean, COVID was, especially the first wave of COVID, there was that huge curveball thrown at us and we were all terrified and we had absolutely no tools. And you know, we weren't even sure if we were supposed to be masking at that point, if you remember.
Yeah.
So we were all terrified at that point. But the biggest difference now, of course, is the vaccine, right? I mean, we now have this really powerful weapon. It's not just a defense, it's an offense, sort of, to fight back, you know, against COVID. And so I think the vaccine and having the vaccine makes a big, big difference in terms of employment.
Well, federal employment benefits are ending, I believe, September 6th. What does this mean
Yes.
for people who've been receiving these benefits? They're going to have to get back to work?
Well, it just means that, I mean, whether they get back to work or not, that is totally, you know, up to them, of course. But what it really means is they will not be able to access these federal programs that have helped a lot of people throughout the pandemic. So that includes everything from that extra $300 that a lot of people talked about that I'm sure many of the listeners have heard about because it was very controversial, depending on what aisle you were in politically. So that program, you know, the extra $300 will be ending. In addition to that, it's also going to end. There was a federal extension of how long you get benefits. So that will be going back to 26 weeks, which is what Indiana's current time limit is for unemployment. And there's a couple other programs for self-employed folks who maybe wouldn't normally qualify for unemployment, for state unemployment, that is. Those programs will also be cut. So after this week, you know, I would expect to see a lot, not necessarily a lot less unemployed people, but a lot less people accessing unemployment insurance.
Right. I mean, I'm just trying to think how, you know, what impact that could potentially have if a lot of people who rely on these benefits, it's just going to be stopped suddenly.
Yeah. I mean, there's been some supposition in, I mean, again, we'll have to see how it pans out, right? Because, you know, one thing that I like to think about as well and remind everyone is, anytime you hear sort of, you know, this could happen, you know, especially from a political party or maybe from a candidate or a politician, you know, there's usually a political reason for that. So, you know, we've heard some people, especially on the left, say things like, you know, you're removing all this money from the economy. You know, all that extra money was stimulating the economy. What will happen when we remove it? Who knows? We'll see. But that is, you know, one thing that people are saying and thinking about.
Well, there have been conversations about repayment. And can you explain what repayment is in light of all of these things right now?
Yeah, so repayment or overpayment, that basically means when people who have accessed unemployment benefits that maybe they weren't supposed to get, and that could either be from a simple error of their own, an error perhaps on the person who was interpreting the claim at DWD, the Department of Workforce Development, that is. You know, so little errors can happen along the way that can maybe put people in the wrong program or disqualify them from a program. And that's kind of where we're at when it comes to unemployment insurance right now. You know, people have been hit with kind of large overpayment notices being told, hey, you were in the wrong program. Now you owe us $5,000. Things like that. I will say for any listener who is in that situation, there is a waiver that you can fill out. And I would encourage you to try to fill out that waiver. If you think that, you know, you got that in error or you don't understand what's going on, or maybe you don't think it's fair. I mean, you can fill out that waiver, ask to get the overpayment waived. And the worst thing they can do is say no.
Right. I mean, yeah, you can always try and then, what is it? Try and then ask permission later. Just go for it first. Well, I was also wondering though, with the repayments, I know, I mean, maybe this is not related, but I was just thinking back, there were some scams where folks were applying for unemployment under other people's names and collecting that. I mean, that could potentially have somebody getting a bill saying you need to pay this back. And it's like, but I never took anything out. So.
Yeah, it could. And there's a separate process for that. That's a really good point. You know, if you got a letter in the mail saying you owe DWD $10,000 and you're like, I never got unemployment insurance. I did not apply for that. I didn't know what was going on. There is a separate avenue for you. Please report the fraud to the Department of Workforce Development. That's what it's called. It's called unemployment insurance fraud. And, you know, it can be kind of frustrating. I've heard from folks that once they, and this is in the past, this was maybe several months ago that I heard this, so maybe it's a little different now, but I know people have also been frustrated with that process where you tell DWD, hey, you know, someone filed for unemployment insurance in my name. I have no idea what's going on. And DWD says, okay, thanks for letting us know. And then you never hear back from them. It's a little worrying. You know, you don't want your credit score to be affected. You don't want to get held, to get your feet held to the fire, right, for that money. But you know, DWD basically has promised, like, just give us some time. We'll figure it out. We'll sort it all out in the end.
Yeah. And I think it's important to note, if you get it in an email or text form, do not click on the links, because I've gotten stuff like that and it's a total scam and I'm panicking like, what? I owe money. And then,
yes. Be very skeptical of anything you see that has unemployment on it. You know, the scammers have gotten very good at copying and pasting DWD's logo and everything and making it look very official. So
yeah.
Very careful.
Right. So go to the actual source, the actual phone number for the department and talk to them, not whatever they're providing you. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with our workforce development reporter, Justin Hicks, about the latest around unemployment in Indiana and all of the other things that go into that. Well, earlier you mentioned Indiana's unemployment rate has remained static for the past few months. Would this be reflective of the entire state, or is it just certain portions?
So there's actually, yeah, for most of the state, by and large, most of the state is at 4%. A lot of parts are actually even better than 4%, which is lower than 4%, of course. You know, and there's a couple of areas, I think like Marion County, you know, Indianapolis area, that might be like, you know, 5-ish%, but still nothing to worry about there. It's still continuing to trickle downwards. There are two anomalies, though, that I noticed in the last monthly report. One is the Gary, Indiana area, Lake County. And that area has always been a little bit higher, you know, a couple percentage points higher. So that is higher. I'm not too worried about that because it's always been a little bit higher. The one that really sticks out to me, though, is Kokomo. That is Howard County. And you see these weird spikes in Howard County's unemployment rate. And I thought that was really interesting. So I called up a guy from the Kokomo Economic Development Committee. And he kind of confirmed what I was thinking, which is, if you know anything about Kokomo, you know that they produce automobile parts there. And as we know, the chip shortage, the supply chain shortages with automobiles is still going on. And the guy from the Economic Development Committee told me he was talking to guys at, I think it's Chrysler, who they make a lot of parts for. They were kind of told that, like, yeah, we're probably going to see supply chain shortages go off and on, maybe into 2022, maybe even 2023. So he said, especially in that Kokomo area where you know, automobile manufacturing is the thing. You expect those spikes, expect those sort of weird up and downs. But again, don't worry too much. At least we know what it is. We just don't know necessarily how to combat it right now.
So that's probably one of the industries in Indiana that isn't doing too well right now. Are there any industries that you see really doing well, making a comeback?
Yeah, I mean, I think by and large, actually, manufacturing is slowly coming back, so that's doing really well. You know, your entertainment industries, arts, leisure, hospitality, those industries, they seem to be kind of making a nice return as well, restaurants. So I think, you know, for the most part, a lot of the numbers are still a little bit lower, than they were before. But remember, before the pandemic, we had a really great labor market. I mean, you know, we had a very, like, almost historically low unemployment rate. So, you know, consider that when you think about that. You know, and of course, with Delta variant still lingering and COVID still causing problems, we'll have to see what happens. And actually, one thing I should have mentioned before, one thing I'm curious to see as well is, as all these kids are going back to school, another thing that we talked a lot about this time last year was how, especially working mothers, it doesn't have to be mothers, but of course, these working parents usually winds up on mothers. When the kid goes to school and then they have to go in isolation and get quarantined and leave school, who has to stay home with that kid, especially if they're really young, you know? So we'll have to see how that affects the labor force as well.
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking about that myself. My kids just went back to school, and I'm lucky enough that I get to work from home. But, you know, when you think about all the other classmates, when it goes into quarantine mode, where's everyone going to go? It's going to cause quite a disruption again, I'm sure.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, we'll have to wait a couple months to see exactly what the size or magnitude of that is. But I'm sure it's going to cause some disruption. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Justin, for joining us this afternoon. It's always a pleasure to have you on board.
Yeah, thanks. Always a pleasure to be here.
Justin Hicks is the Workforce Development Reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. After a quick break, we'll learn about efforts to boost vaccination rates in rural communities. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. When we talk about vaccination rates across the country, oftentimes rural areas are noted to trail behind urban and suburban communities in fully vaccinated populations. But many have not lost hope in those rural communities. Some are now looking to farmers to be the trusted voices in their communities to encourage their neighbors to get the vaccine. To learn more about this, we're joined now by Christine Herman, reporter for Side Effects Public Media and Illinois Public Media, who recently worked on a feature on farmers being the key to boosting rural vaccination rates. Welcome to the program, Christine.
Thank you, Miriam. It's good to be here.
How did you find out that rural areas were having such low vaccination rates?
Yeah, well, this is something that's been pretty widely reported. If you're, you know, I'm sure people will remember back, 10 months ago now when the vaccine was first, you know, rolling out, late December of last year, early January, and healthcare workers and elderly people were first eligible. There were a lot of people kind of sounding the alarm about, you know, the mRNA vaccine. It's this two-dose vaccine. It needs ultra-cold temperatures, which maybe some rural areas, rural health departments that have been underfunded for years, for decades, may not have those resources to be able to even store this vaccine. So there was a lot of concern at the start about access. And as you mentioned, you know, the concern now is more so about trust and lack of understanding and misinformation driving lower vaccination rates in rural areas because, you know, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine came out and it required cold temperatures, but not as ultra cold. And obviously there've been lots of efforts in various places to get the vaccine out. And now it's pretty widely available. You can say that there still could be access issues, but that's been less of a concern from the rural health experts I've talked to lately.
And when it comes to this particular angle that you took with the story, what compelled you to dig into this?
Yeah, so actually, I learned about the National Rural Health Association saying that they're going to team up, or that they've started teaming up with the National Farmers Union to boost rural vaccination rates. And my ears perked up. I just sort of, you know, just started reaching out to talk to the folks who are kind of leading this at the national level. And I was like, you know, what's the idea behind this? And really, it's just that, you know, I mentioned trust is so important. And they were saying, really, it's because farmers in rural communities are sometimes some of the most trusted voices in those areas. So, you know, we've heard talk about in getting religious leaders on board to reach, you know, people in different faith communities. And so this was sort of another idea, another angle, another strategy that was being kind of approached at this national level. And I wanted to kind of dig in and see, okay, how is this actually playing out on the ground?
And what reasons did you come across? I mean, you mentioned earlier there's, you know, so much misinformation and things that are being spread. But when it comes to rural areas, is it the same misinformation that is preventing folks from getting vaccinated?
Yeah, that's my sense, because I did ask this question from, you know, I talked to several farmers in rural areas, and I did ask them about this. And yeah, it is kind of a lot of the same that I'm sure people have heard about. You know, there even one farmer himself said, I've used vaccines in my animals, but even I was a little bit, you know, kind of wondering, like, how did they get the vaccine developed and out so fast? And he had concerns about safety and could it possibly be safe if it was rolled out so quickly? And of course, we know that, you know, scientists have been saying there were no safety corners cut in these clinical trials. The reason they were able to roll out the vaccine so quickly is that, unlike previous vaccines, they started manufacturing these vaccines before the trials were finished, so that if the trials showed they were safe and effective, they could immediately start administering the vaccines. And that's what we saw happen. But of course, you know, that was one concern I heard. And then, you know, the extreme is that there are conspiracy theories, as we all know, misinformation. And even the farmers themselves says it's hard to know who to trust when there's so much information coming from so many different places. And of course, the way this has become politicized so heavily, unfortunately, like all the other public health guidance throughout the pandemic, also the vaccine has become a politicized issue. So I think it's kind of the combination of all those factors, based on what I learned in my reporting.
And I think, you know, when I hear from folks that are nervous because they say it's produced so quickly, I think it's just hard for us to realize how far technology has come, you know, in our time before the previous vaccinations that took so long. So it's like we have a lot of technology and good things on our end now that we can make use of.
Yeah. And I realize it's something that can be tricky to understand. I mean, I studied science before I became a journalist, so I knew what mRNA was. I knew what, like, delivery vesicles were. And I knew that this vaccine platform using mRNA had been in development for years before, you know, SARS-CoV-2 came along. And so and I knew that genetic sequencing technology has been developed so rapidly. So when this new virus was sequenced, the vaccine companies that had already developed this technology for years, they were able to just quickly, you know, get that genetic code and drop it in and you know, pretty rapidly start doing testing on the safety and efficacy of the vaccine. So, but I understand that, you know, a lot of people don't have that understanding, and it's a lot to keep up with the science, and especially when you're trying to sort through, okay, well, you're saying this, but someone else is saying this, and how do I know who I can trust?
Absolutely. And your feature touches on that idea, as we've been talking of farmers being the people that could boost vaccination rates in rural areas. We do have a clip here from a cattle rancher on his thoughts. Let's take a listen.
I think in our rural communities, I think about farmers or ranchers and families that have been there for generations. They are trusted, respected members of our communities. You know, everybody looks at Joe down the road and thinks, hey, you know, what might be his experiences on this topic or this issue, or kind of listens to what he or she may say. And so I think being able to involve those trusted members of our community, the older members of our community that have been there quite some time, has a huge impact in being able to share accurate information or address concerns in our rural communities. You know, I think on a day-to-day basis, you know, when I'm out looking at our cattle or taking care of them or whatever it might be, moving them from pasture to pasture, I might only see my neighbors, you know, across the fence line or when we're driving up and down the rural roads. And so word of mouth still has a huge impact in how messages and information are shared in rural America.
That's an amazing sound bite there. Who were you talking to?
That's Ryan Goodman. He's a cattle rancher. He used to live in Colorado until fairly recently. He moved out to a rural part of Virginia. But he's actually been, when he was back in Colorado, the Colorado Health Department reached out to him and asked if he would be willing to partner with them because he's pretty active on social media and on Instagram and Twitter. He's at Beef Runner. And they asked if he would be involved in just helping to promote the vaccine to his followers and also to his rural community. And so that's how he got involved and has been pretty active on that front.
And he mentioned that word of mouth still has a huge impact. I think maybe we often forget that because we're so wrapped up in social media and connecting in that way that we forget there's another way to connect.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's kind of like human nature. We when we're bombarded with information on a topic, like, you know, even me as a health reporter, I can't go read all the original research studies on every aspect and then do an assessment of all the information and then decide, okay, based on my thorough analysis, this is what I'm going to believe. A lot of us, every person, no matter where you are kind of on the left-right divide or politically or, you know, whatever it is, we rely on the people we trust to kind of, you know, help us know how to process information and even, you know, what to believe about things. And so that's, I think, the point he was making there, that even in rural communities, farmers are more trusted than sometimes even, you know, health experts, especially since, you know, if you tune into national media, they've got, you know, health experts from, you know, big cities, large academic institutions, and they're not from like our community. Like why should I trust that person? But it's like, oh, you know, he said Joe down the road, like, well, this is someone I can trust. And oh, he's saying that, oh, you know, vaccines are, you know, effective at preventing illness. Oh, okay, well, maybe I'll give that some more thought. Even though I've been hearing that same thing, you know, maybe people have already been hearing that message, but when you hear it from a person you trust, it hits differently. I think that's sort of like the interesting, like, human psychology piece of this.
And another interesting thing I think is also that farmers are used to the term like herd immunity for their own livestock. And we do have a clip here from a farmer who talks about the importance of vaccines. Let's take a listen.
And being a livestock producer, I'm well aware of vaccinations and vaccines, and that's how we develop immunity in our animals. Beef animals and hogs, we're always vaccinating the breeding stock to pass on immunity to the little ones.
So does that give you a sense? First of all, I guess if you could tell us who that was.
Yeah, that was Tom Arnold. He's a cattle rancher, raises cattle, hogs, and chickens in Elizabeth, Illinois, which is a small rural town in the northwest corner of the state.
And so it sounds like, you know, farmers are aware of vaccinations and vaccines and the benefits of them. Is there any hesitancy towards vaccination because they feel like it's something more designed for animals than humans?
You know, I tried to get a general sense of, you know, since farmers understand vaccines and understand the science because of the work they do with animals, would that make them more likely to trust vaccines that were developed for humans? And, you know, there's really not good data on that. Like, farmers haven't been surveyed to ask their position on the vaccine. But the handful of people I talk to, you know, they understand the science. They know what's in a vaccine. They know how it works. And as you mentioned, they know why herd immunity is so important. If you can protect, you know, if you can get immunity in your herd of animals, even if the vaccine's not 100% effective, because none of them are, you know, it protects the ones who are either unvaccinated or, you know, who maybe have waning immunity, the more people who you can get immunized through the vaccine. So they understand the technology. They can explain that science part of it, which I think is why the National Rural Health Association was interested in particular in getting farmers on board, because not only are they trusted, but they have this knowledge, you know, kind of, you know, perhaps unlike most, you know, faith leaders who, you know, maybe didn't study science. But a lot of farmers do have that background and that knowledge. So they can speak to the technological component as well as kind of understand like rural values and where people are coming from and why they might be hesitant and how to talk with them.
Do farmers seem on board overall, the ones that you talk to, with promoting the vaccine in their communities, or are there some that are still hesitant?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, even Tom, the guy you just heard, you know, he was like, you know, I think, yeah, farmers are trusted, but also we're really busy. So he, you know, he told me that actually the main reason he hasn't been more active is one, it is a little bit scary, even for someone like him to talk about it because of how politicized it gets. He's like, I don't want to get into an argument with people. And a lot of people have already made up their minds, like, and there's no changing it. You know, and he said, like, you know, if people ask me, or if it comes up, I'll mention, oh, I understand how vaccines work. And if they want to know more, he'll have that conversation. But he said a lot of times people don't ask. And, you know, it's interesting because the vaccine rollout has also overlapped with some of the busiest times for farmers, planting season in the spring. And then, you know, I'm not an ag reporter, so I can't speak to all the details, but this is what the farmers have told me. You know, it's been a really busy time the past year, especially since they're also kind of reeling from the effects of the pandemic economically on their industry. So, but, you know, others, you know, say that they do want to be more active. And so I think it kind of runs the gamut. And that's part of the reason why there's this campaign with the National Farmers Union. You know, they're trying to kind of nudge farmers to be a little bit more vocal. It doesn't have to be a big flashy thing. But even just these word of mouth conversations, they say, it's like sort of like the vaccine battle at this point is sort of going to be like one person at a time. Because a lot of people who are hesitant maybe can be nudged, but it's not going to happen from like people coming in and like, I don't know, like you can't shame people into changing their mind or call people ignorant, you know, for not getting the vaccine and think that that's going to work. It's really about relationship building and trust building.
Absolutely.
At this point.
If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Christine Herman, reporter for Side Effects Public Media and Illinois Public Media, about some feature reporting she's done on farmers and the COVID vaccine. Christine, have you seen farmers encouraging their neighbors to get the vaccine? I know you mentioned that they're just super busy right now. Have there been any other, I guess, efforts you've heard of or programs?
Yeah, so I should mention that there are like farmers who have been involved in trying to get their workforce vaccinated. So that's something I learned by talking with the National Rural Health Association. So a lot of farmers have agricultural workers, migrant farm workers that travel from place to place, sometimes from other countries, to come here and work on the farms. And I've met farmers who have, in prior reporting, who've been pretty active with trying to get those workers access to the vaccine. So every state kind of varied in terms of prioritizing where agricultural workers would be eligible for the vaccine. And at least in Illinois, Illinois was one of the states that they did put ag workers kind of high on the eligibility list, recognizing that they're essential workers and should have access to the vaccine. So there's definitely that happening in lots of different places. And you know, and also there's, you know, the extension programs, which I know a lot of land grant institutions will have like sort of outreach in rural areas. And there have been definitely efforts to reach out and, you know, and sometimes agricultural leaders and ag workers are involved in those programs. So there's also that sort of thing happening as well, place to place.
And you know, as we're talking about the pandemic having an impact, including in agriculture. We do have a clip from the vice president of advocacy for the National Farmers Union. Let's take a listen.
So many other factors, including shutdowns in processing facilities due to outbreaks in our communities, certainly had a big impact on farmers' farming operations and our marketing. So there's been so much upheaval in the agriculture economy and in our communities because of the pandemic. We need to start moving past that. And vaccines are the way towards that. And that's what our organization has been supporting.
And who is this that we just heard from?
Yeah, that's Mike Strands. He's the vice president of advocacy for the National Farmers Union.
And it sounds like, you know, everyone's on board with the vaccinations and seeing that it affected even, you know, processing facilities. And when there's outbreaks, everything has to be shut down. Does that seem like an impetus for more folks to pay attention to getting vaccinated?
You know, I think that's the idea behind the way they're trying to frame the message, for sure. You know, Mike explained to me that really getting farmers on board is also a matter of conveying that this is in your best interest to get as many people protected from the virus as possible to help, you know, to help the agricultural industry itself recover and heal and move forward. So that's definitely the idea behind this campaign and the message that they're trying to get across to farmers who are maybe like, why should that be my job? You know, I'm not a public health expert. So, you know, and also they put out this online toolkit, which I mentioned in my story, to try to, you know, provide farmers with resources, with talking points for how to have conversations with your neighbors who maybe are vaccine hesitant. Also with, they've even included a template for if you want to write an op-ed for your local newspaper and share some of your experience and your personal story. You know, they've got different ways they're trying to nudge people and farmers in particular to kind of be a little bit more proactive on this front without hopefully requiring too much of a heavy lift, understanding that this is not their job, that they have a full-time job in farming.
Well, thank you so much, Christine, for joining us. It's been a pleasure. Christine Herman is a reporter for Side Effects Public Media and Illinois Public Media. After a quick break, we'll be back to talk about a new Indianapolis Fine Arts Fair featuring the work of Black artists across the country. If you have any questions for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. I'm Miriam Soap. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. There's a new fine arts fair featuring the work of 38 Black artists from across the country coming to Indianapolis this week. And with us here to tell us all about the Butter Fine Arts Fair is Molly Jeffers, co-founder of Gang Gang, a cultural development firm. Welcome, Molly.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
I have to ask, why Butter? Why is that the name of this fine arts fair?
Oh, my gosh. Well, we love the attributes of butter and think that it fits really well with the art fair. You know, everybody has a relationship with butter. Butter adds to everything. It's essential. It's delicious, you know. And it's the same way we think about art made by Black visual artists.
And what can people expect to see at the Butter Art Fair? Will there be art carved out of butter? I mean, that's just what I'm thinking right now.
Well, you know what? It's funny that you ask, because that is one of the surprise elements at Butter, is actually a sculpture made out of butter. So yes, whoever finds that Easter egg in the fair, that'll be a nice surprise. But there are gallery style walls featuring the work of 38 Black visual artists from around the country, and creative programming all weekend. People will see bands and a DJ booth. There's 14 DJs that are playing across the weekend. And so it's really a multi-sensory kind of creative experience. That's how I'd call it.
This sounds amazing. I feel like I'm going to have to come out of hiding this week.
Yes, you absolutely should.
All right. Apologies about that. You know, of course, my internet decided to die on me in the middle of this conversation.
Oh, no. At least we had music, you know.
We got to play music to make everything sound good. So, yeah. So where did the idea of this art fair come from?
Visiting many other art fairs here in Indianapolis and around the country, Alan Bacon, my Gang Gang partner and life partner, we've been to the last couple of Miami Art Basels and had some inspiration there and thought, how could we bring even a sense of this to the Midwest? And then being in Indianapolis and, you know, kind of everything that was 2020 and, you know, everyone focusing on showing the work of Black art, you know, showing the work of art made by Black people, we thought we could really turn this up a notch. You know, we could do this in a different way and have our own, you know, and have a different context for, you know, how to show the art.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, that's awesome, because also I'm just thinking about how the pandemic just really opened up creativity and time to sort of reflect and think. And this is the first time you're having the Butter Fine Arts Fair. What are your thoughts going into it right now?
Oh, gosh. Well, we actually just completed day one. You know, the kickoff to Butter was the mural dedication, which is the first mural on the exterior of the historic Stutz building. And so right there at 11th and Senate, there is now a 90 by 36 foot mural featuring kind of keepers of culture. And so we just completed that dedication. There were 150 people who showed up, and it was so lovely and joyous, and the mood was there, and it was an absolute perfect kickoff to this multi-day fine art fair. And I think people are looking forward to coming this weekend even more. So I'm feeling pretty good.
Well, what was it like organizing this event with your team and the artists? I'm sure it's a lot of work behind the scenes.
So much work. This would not have happened without assembling, you know, a team of makers, of course, some artists, curators, builders, florists. I mean, the team is massive, and it's been really intense. You know, we've been working on this. That spark that I had for, you know, the idea for the event was in November of 2020. And so to think about, what are we, in September, you know, like all of those months, every day we have been putting together, a new art fair for Indianapolis and a new art fair to like appreciate our artists here and really elevate the narrative around creatives here in the Midwest and especially artists that happen to be Black artists here in Indianapolis. So it's been very intense. It's been a lot of fun, but really lovely.
Well, in an Indianapolis Recorder article, you mentioned that there are art shows here in town that feature Black artists, and you thought that you could have shows that do better justice and be more intentional and authentic and figure out how to elevate the narrative around the Black talent in Indianapolis. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure, sure. You know, I think after everything that was 2020, right, the racial kind of uprising and the world's reckoning with racism, especially here in our country, you know, it seemed like the response from galleries and, you know, exhibitions and representers was to show the work of Black artists. And while that is admirable, it didn't feel like enough. It didn't feel like it just feel like we could take that a step further. And so, you know, the context and the intentionality around Butter is just different. It takes things up a notch. It elevates the narrative around experiencing this type of art, and even the care that went into the process of with the artist of, you know, how to price your work, how to install your work and the lighting, you know, with your work, like all of that was very intentional and cared for and thought through, which, you know, it happens, you know, with galleries, of course, and museums and exhibitions, but we're past the point, I think, of just showing art and thinking that that's enough. You know, the goal of Butter is to sell 100% of the works in the show and for 100% of the profit to return back to the artist. So there's almost a reparational slant here, with the goals of Butter in mind to really make it about the artist.
That's amazing. And I wish you the best on making that goal. And I think you can set precedent for so many art fairs.
Yes. Yeah. It's kind of a new, like, equitable model that we're testing out here in the arts industry, you know, to see how we can better support the careers of these artists versus, you know, just showing their work.
Well, how did you choose artists for this fair? Because if I remember correctly, you have 38 artists coming in. How was that process like?
Yeah, there are 38 artists, again, from not just Indianapolis based, but the curatorial team is really important in that process. So there's myself and Alan Bacon, Brady Euless, Samuel Levi Jones, Alelia Bundles, and Sarah Hoover. So we are the team of curators who, all came together with our list of artists that we wanted to be in this inaugural Butter, in this inaugural show. And we put our list together and kind of went into the war room for a week and said, okay, what's it going to be? You know, who stays for this year? Who can we save? And, you know, like really cutting down. And that was a really tough part of the process.
Yeah, it's always tough when there's a lot of great stuff coming through.
Oh, there's so much amazing talent. I mean, especially in Indianapolis, we could have had 100 artists, you know. So that was a tough part, but we're really excited about the 38 that are showing in Butter this year.
And are all of them from the Midwest or are they spread out?
They're pretty spread out. There are 22 that are indie based now. And then there are a few like Will Watson, who is from Indianapolis, but went to D.C. and made this huge art career there. And so we're like bringing him back home, which feels really nice, you know, to even say, hey, like you can make it here, you know, even for the ones who've left and or, you know, those who want to stay. A part of Butter is saying you can thrive as an artist here. Like you can have a career here. You don't always have to go to DC. So yes, there's representation from across the country. A lot of Atlanta based artists as well.
Well, if you have any questions or comments for our guest today, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Molly Jeffers, co-founder of Gang Gang, a cultural development firm, and the Butterfine Arts Fair that they're putting on this week. Molly, just for our listeners to know, when is this fair running exactly?
Yes, it is September 3rd through the 5th. So this Friday through Sunday, and Friday is from 4 to 10, Saturday 11 to 10, and then on Sunday from 11 to 6.
I do want to also talk about you, your organization. You're the co-founder of Gang Gang. What is your organization about?
Sure. Yeah. Gang Gang is a cultural development firm. And so we work to produce, promote, and preserve culture in cities. We are about kind of reparations in the creative space. You know, we have identified, along with, you know, America's historians and Google specifically, that Black creatives have influenced America at least for the last 15 years. Black creatives are the most searched on Google, the most copied. They are the influencers, but they don't own the assets in the cultural sector. And so Gang Gang is here to kind of change that, to pay back the culture that has shaped America and to look for opportunities to spark activity in the creative economy. So we're all about supporting creatives because that's what, you know, makes our cities vibrant and viable. And so not taking care of your creatives is kind of like not taking care of your city in a way.
Well, it's interesting. You're talking about the influence for the last 15 years. I would probably argue forever there's been influence.
I would too, but that's what's been proven, you know.
but how do you take hold of that? You know, like you said, artists are the most searched on Google and things like that. How can you combat that, I guess, from people appropriating?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think it's about trying to offer more ownership and more power. And I mean, it's kind of like with Butter, you know, like we are not taking any fees from the artists. They're not going to lose any money with Butter. So it's kind of I think it's about lifting up, supporting, highlighting, but also finding ways to then pay them back, quite literally, you know, whether that's like booking them for a gig and paying them at least, you know, fair or higher than fair, you know, amounts, or looking for opportunities and new bottles like we're doing with Butter that says, okay, they're, you know, we're not going to take 25 to 40% after we sell your piece. You're going to get 100% of the money for the art that you made. And so I think that's one of the way to like give power back, give ownership back. That's how we're thinking about kind of reparations in the creative space.
I mean, I love that model that you're putting through, because I'm just thinking of so many industries where if you want to show your work or do anything, there's huge fees you have to pay. And
right.
And then it's like, unless you're privileged enough to have all this money to just throw at entrance fees,
right,
you might never get your work seen.
Exactly. That's one of the barriers that exist for artists, you know, and especially artists of color. You know, there's a barrier to even enter, right? Because booth fees can go from $200 to $700 for some of these fairs. And then on the back end, you know, if they sell a piece, they are then, you know, taking off another 25, 35, 40%. And so the artists then are approaching, you know, showing their work with this frame of reference of how much money am I going to make or lose by doing this versus just thinking about their art, you know? And so, yeah, it's kind of an all around looking at the artist from as a whole person and as, you know, for their careers.
Well, when it comes to Gang Gang, what other things are you working on? I know you have this fair coming up. Are there any other initiatives?
Oh gosh, yeah. So we completed the Kickback series recently with 10 East Art. We did that last winter. There was a live music series that we organized in a safe way during COVID, and the community loved it so much that we came back in the spring. Gang Gang was the creative directors for Swish, which was the art component of March Madness. When Indianapolis hosted the tournament, we coordinated 263 performances over the course of the 4 weekends that the tournament was in Indianapolis. And that went really well and kind of brought our downtown back to life. So there will be a next iteration of that this year. So that will be what we turn to next for the fall, is kind of the next iteration of Swish.
And what, why, I guess, Indiana, I'm curious, the focus for Gang Gang to be in this state and as opposed to, I don't know, New York or Chicago?
You know, I think because of that question, you know, like it's because of that question that we're starting and going so big here in Indianapolis, which is our home. You know, Gang Gang is, I think, very quickly going to come out of Indiana and kind of spread our wings and spread the creatives all over the country, which we're, you know, kind of doing now with the art fair by putting our artists on the same ticket and the same platform with other artists. But we love Indianapolis. You know, I'm from Indianapolis. Alan is from Indianapolis. So this is our home base. We know our city and we kind of know what it needs in this moment, you know, and even to come out of everything that was 2020, the response we feel is a more vibrant city and a more equitable city by way of the creative economy.
And you were at an event this morning for the fair. Can you tell us a little bit about that and the feedback you've received so far?
Yes. So this morning was the mural dedication at 11:30. And oh, my goodness, it was just such a beautiful kickoff to Butter. We started with community very intentionally so, and this was outside. So no one is still, you know, come inside of Butter. This was an outdoor 45-minute long program to just kind of kick things off and reveal a mural made by Ashley Nora, which is so beautiful and honors eight Indianapolis luminaries, eight Black culturalists that have offered so much to our city and beyond. So it was a wonderful kickoff this morning, and we are so thankful to the community for showing up and our partnership with the Indianapolis Recorder and, you know, just kind of maintaining the storytelling aspect within our culture in Indianapolis.
This all sounds so exciting to me because I'm new to Indiana by way of Chicago, and it's just nice to hear about all this programming and arts and culture. It's awesome.
Yes. Well, so many people run off to Chicago on the weekends to find culture, you know, so it's like, we got to retain our talent, you know, we've got to retain ourselves, you know, so yeah, I'm so glad you said that.
Well, what plans do you have in the future, whether it's with Butter Arts Fair or Gang Gang in general?
Well, I think with Butter, I mean, it kind of has to grow at this point. We're already thinking about what to add for Butter 2, you know, so I think that will quickly become kind of a Midwest staple that is based in Indianapolis. I think people will come to Butter or expect Butter to be a place where you can buy fine art made by, you know, Black artists. So I think that's got some legs to grow. And with Gang Gang, you know, we have coordinated so many opportunities for creatives in just the past year that it almost feels like we've got to now spread out. You know, we've got to get these artists showing in other cities in the Midwest and across the country, you know, so more people can know about the creatives in Indianapolis. And so I think that's coming up next. Yeah, kind of spreading the wings a little more.
Well, we'll definitely keep an eye on it. And thank you so much for joining us. Molly Jeffers is the co-founder of Gang Gang, a cultural development firm in Indianapolis. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. You can always find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.